May my song, may our song always be how marvelous, how great, how wonderful our Savior's love for me, for us. Amen. My name is Ron Giese. I'm the administrative pastor here, also the pastor over leadership development, and I'm not Ryan Kelly. One application of that is if you've taken your sermon notes page out of your bulletin and you're ready to take notes, that's not today's sermon. What happened was maybe midnight, 1, 2 a.m., Ryan got hit with some kind of stomach flu thing that has just knocked him out. So this happens real rarely. I think the last time was 4 or 5 years ago when Bill Reed, one of our former elders who's still very involved in church here, kind of stepped in. And in fact, the truth is more that probably in between 5 years ago and now, I'm guessing Sarah would easily tell us there are times when Ryan gets up 5 a.m. on Sunday and he's not feeling well. But he comes in sometimes and just plays sick, to use an athletic term. Kind of thing where you see an NBA player play and he's got his game on and everything's going good. And you might notice he's just not smiling as much as he usually does. And then after the game, the commentator comes along and says, you know what? He didn't have any sleep last night. He was up with a stomach flu the whole night, but knew he had to play. So every once in a while, like once in every 5 years, that's not even possible. The player just says, some other guy's got to come in from the bench. So I'm your basketball number 11 guy off the bench. I like playing pickup basketball. I'm not good at layups or driving. I'm not good at dribbling. I can play a little bit of defense, and I can do set shots from the shoulder of the key, which is kind of a mid-range, not layups, but not three-pointers. So I'm just going to do a couple set shots today. That's what I'm going to do. Actually, I'm going to give you two sermons. So I know you're already thinking, wait a minute, that means like an hour 50 minutes, but I promise you it won't be that long. One is going to be on the four Gospels and will be a more in-depth talk from one I gave at Lord's Supper a year or two ago. And then I thought since Ryan is in Luke, I would share with you my favorite thing about Luke. So that's the mini sermon that'll come after that. Let me ask you to do one thing, though. This is for anybody visiting, this gray tear-off communication card at the bottom of your sermon notes, which, of course, you won't use unless you just take other notes on them. And again, it's for visitors to let us know you're with us. You'd take this to that visitor's reception, for instance, in the West Wing. But there is a place for comments. And let me ask, I think it'd be awesome if a couple dozen of you wrote Ryan a note. Just let him know you're praying for him and that you appreciate him. I don't know if you have any idea what it's like to preach every Sunday. And on top of that, do biblical counseling, mentor younger guys, and a dozen other things that Ryan does. I tried that for about 6 months once in Virginia and found out it wasn't for me. It was just too much. And so if we could get, you'll put these in the offering boxes as you go out back at the end of the service. It'd be so awesome if we could dump some of those on his desk. Genuine notes of appreciation. It's not Pastor Appreciation Month. I think that's October. But if we let our teaching elder know and just kind of make May 31st our Teaching Elder Appreciation Day, that'd be great if he could do that. So, before we start into sermon number one, I want to tell you an imagined accident, automobile accident. Let's pretend that there's a 3 or 4 car collision at Montgomery and San Mateo. And let's further suppose that there are 4 witnesses, pedestrians, not involved in cars, and they were just nicely positioned at each of the 4 corners, northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast. And they happen to be looking into the intersection, or maybe they hear a car brake, and they glance immediately and catch the whole accident that happens. Police officer comes along and takes testimony from all 4 of those eyewitnesses. Now, will what any individual witness relates be the full reality of what happened? No. I guess only God knows the full reality of all that was involved in that accident. They're going to give you one perspective. But what might happen is those 4 accounts could be contradictory or they could be complementary. How could they be contradictory? Well, maybe one person, because they overstretched their bounds as an eyewitness, maybe one person says, I know what caused the accident. It was the guy in the blue car. He's the cause of the whole thing. And that's the southeast corner. The northwest corner says, oh, I know what caused the accident. It was a truck driver that was talking on a cell phone. And they contradict each other. But another way that this could play out is that they complement one another. They don't overstep their bounds. Each one is completely accurate on what they saw, but they dovetail with each other. So a northwest corner guy says, all I saw was a car hit the brakes, and that's what started the whole chain reaction. But the southeast lady that witnessed it says, I saw a cat run out in front of that car that hit the brakes. And now you get a fuller picture of what's happening. Well, of course, that's what's happening in the four Gospels. Not contradictory, complementary. And it gives us a fuller picture of who Jesus is. So open up your Bibles to Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. What we're going to see is four Gospels, one Jesus. Not four Gospels, four different Jesuses. Four Gospels, one Jesus. So if you were at that Lord's Supper a year or two ago, this would be great review, because I'm guessing if I quizzed you, go through the four Gospels, what's the audience for each one and what are some of the emphases? A lot of us would come up a little bit short on a ready, from memory answer for all four of those. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Right away we see the audience for Matthew's gospel, which is Jewish. Check out these terms. Record, genealogy, that kind of speaks about tradition, chronology, roots, where Jesus came from. Then you've got the word Messiah, and then you've got the names David and Abraham. In fact, let me show you something really neat about Matthew. You heard Ryan say this last week. Look at the beginning and end of a psalm or a book of the Bible or a chapter. So I want to show you something. It's in Matthew chapter 1, and it's at the very end of Matthew. That'll kind of go along with this thought that we see right away in verse 1. This is about tradition, about things from Genesis, the book of Genesis onward. This is about God's plan for Christ to be the culmination, the fulfillment through all history of redemption. Look later in chapter 1, verse 23, we read this. It's a quote from Isaiah, actually. Verse 23, behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. So keep that in the back of your mind. Emmanuel, prophesied from the Old Testament. What does it mean, God with us? Look at the end of Matthew, way back to chapter 28. At the very end of Matthew, chapter 28, at the end of that chapter is what we call the great mission of the church. Jesus gives the most detailed account of what the church should be doing. And at the end of that, the very last verse, we read this, verse 20. Jesus says, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am, hear those two words again, with you, always, even to the end of the age. See the book ending? Matthew 1, Emmanuel means God with us. Jesus says, I'm God, I'm the person that it was prophesied of, and I'm not only with you now, I will be with you through the end of human history as you know it. Let's look back at chapter 1, verse 1. There are two interesting words here that in my New American Standard are represented as record and genealogy. You might have a different word than record. But the Greek word for record is biblos, from which we get Bible. Literally means book. So Matthew chapter 1, verse 1 literally says this is the book of the Greek Genesis. We'd say Genesis, from which we get our name for the book of Genesis. This is the book of a beginning, a birthing, of what? The Messiah. So again, this grand scheme from Genesis to the end of the age is what Matthew is after. And more specifically, the Old Testament background, the roots of Jesus. One person said that Matthew is the bridge that leads us from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And man, that's a great analogy. It's the first positionally in the New Testament, and it's got so much stuff about the Old Testament in Matthew. Here's some key vocabulary terms and concepts. What I'll do, since you don't really have sermon notes, is post these up, like these terms, on Tuesday or Wednesday when we get the sermon uploaded. But some key vocabulary: kingdom of heaven, righteousness. Of course, Jesus in Matthew is going to tell us what real righteousness is. Holy city. Jesus has an interest in law, Sabbath. Matthew has an interest in Messiah, prophecy, defilement. All of these speak to a Jewish background. So as we wrap up Matthew, you might say, okay, well, if it's written to a Jewish audience, I'm not Jewish, I'm Gentile, maybe I don't need to read that then. No, a couple reasons. One is that Matthew, more than any other gospel actually, speaks to the church. In fact, it's the only one of the four gospels that mentions the name church. You'll find that in Matthew chapter 16 and 18. And the other gospels, I mean, they'll talk about the church in some sense, but not use the word. Matthew is the only gospel that has a verb for disciple or to make disciples several times in his book. So it's not just Jewish, it's transitional. It's letting Jews know you've got to make the transition to the new covenant. And it's probably letting us Gentiles know you need to better appreciate the Old Testament background to this man, this person, this God called Messiah. All right, maybe one or two things about Matthew. Matthew, along with one other gospel, has more speeches of Jesus, we call them sermons, than other gospels, especially more than Mark or Luke. And these are not really to a Jewish audience. They're more for us. The Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5, 6, 7, what is called the Manual for the Church by some commentators, Matthew chapter 18, the whole chapter is to the church. Matthew chapters 24, 25, spoken by Jesus a few days before his crucifixion, talking about things that are future, even for our time. So, great place to go for some sermons by Jesus. And of course, again, a great place to look at the Old Testament, which as Christians, we should not be ignorant of. Rather, we should revel in it, rejoice in it, celebrate it, study it, not use it as a reference book. Number two, Mark. If Jesus is a rabbi in Matthew, which is going to be an R word that I'm going to give you for Matthew. In Mark, Jesus is going to be a rebel. So a different perspective on who Jesus is. Let me read for you. You can turn there yourself too. The first verse from Mark. Mark chapter 1, verse 1. By the way, in this verse, we're not going to read about a Jewish background because Mark is not written to Jews. He's writing to Romans in the Roman Empire. Chapter 1, verse 1. The beginning, here's our word beginning again. We'll actually see that in all four Gospels, in their first few verses. But here it's a little bit of a different beginning. It's not so much the beginning back to Genesis of the Messiah, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Mark is really about the gospel message, maybe more so than the other three, although all four are obviously about the gospel. In fact, here in our church, we do a course called Christianity Explored. We do it every spring and fall, which is a video-based course, which is based on guess which gospel? Gospel of Mark. Because Mark is great at saying who Jesus is and what he does. Let's go back to that idea of a rebel. A rebel does things as well as says things and believes things. And Mark is a lot about what Jesus does and what he calls upon us to follow in doing. And Mark is a lot about suffering. Because as Jesus does these things in this godly rebellion taking place against not human powers or politicians or governments, but against the powers of darkness of this world, as this rebellion takes place, Jesus will do things as well as say and believe things. And there will be a cost paid. along the lines of suffering persecution. So Mark highlights suffering persecution and says to us, if you follow Jesus, this may happen to you as well. Let me give you a few sample stories in Mark. We won't turn there. You could write them down, look at them later. In Mark chapter 5, Jesus heals a guy who is filled internally, possessed by demons. In fact, those demons have a name, and the name is Legion, a good Roman name. They're very strong, but Jesus comes along and expels the demons from this guy and heals him. Great picture for a Roman audience and a Roman empire of the authority that Jesus has from God the Father. Because Romans thought a lot about strength and numbers and authority. Another sample story in Mark. In Mark chapter 6, we read about John the Baptist and his confronting of Herod. Why does he confront Herod? Herod has taken another man's wife, actually his brother's wife, to be his own after he's been already married and he puts away his first wife. We would call that, especially if it happens before some kind of formal divorce, we'd call that adultery. And that's what John the Baptist calls it. He gets put in jail for that and loses his head because of that confrontation. Why does Mark include that? Because in the Roman Empire, guess what? It's very common for men to divorce and marry someone else. Or while they're married, to take a mistress. Now, do guys in Albuquerque take mistresses? I don't think it's all that common. And yet, when you think about it, maybe it is common if the mistress is a picture on the screen of a laptop or a desktop hidden away when no one watches. So maybe the more we think about it, maybe our culture is not all that different than Rome of the first century. We just hide things better, perhaps, than they did. So the rebel in the Gospel of Mark is doing things as well as saying and believing things and asks us to follow. Here's one more example for Mark that we'll actually look at. Turn to Mark chapter 3 if you're open to Mark. In Mark chapter 3, at the beginning of the chapter, first few verses, Jesus is in a synagogue and he heals a guy who has a withered hand. Somehow his hand is deformed. His fingers don't all work. There's no good muscle there. And he can't use his hand. So this is what we read in verse 5. After looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he, Jesus, said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he, the man, stretched it out, and his hand was restored. What I want you to notice here under this rubric of Jesus the rebel is that we're reading about the emotions of Jesus. Did Jesus ever get angry? Answer has to be yes. We read about it right here. Was he ever grieved over something? Yes, we read about it right here. So one thing Mark does is give us insight into the emotions of Jesus, not just his actions or his words. And that's typical of a rebel, isn't it? They're passionate about something. Now, the anger Jesus feels is going to be a righteous anger. The anger you and I probably more often than not feel and exhibit and turn into action is usually unrighteous anger. But it's possible to have a godly kind of anger, and Jesus had that. Mark is the only gospel where we read about Jesus being angry. Now, those of you who know your Bibles might say, Ron, I think you're wrong there. There's another gospel, another account where we read about Jesus being angry. It's when he cleansed the temple. He went into the temple. You guys remember this? Can you kind of nod your heads if you do? And there are businessmen in there trying to make money. They're using God's house, his holy temple, to make dollars and cents, so to speak. But that's in John and one other gospel. But we actually don't read about Jesus being angry. I think it's a safe assumption he is, but we don't read the word anger. We just read about what he did. Here in Mark, we read about Jesus being angry or grieved. So Mark presents us with Jesus as a rebel. Mark uses very forceful and straightforward language. We have the word immediately in your translation. It might be straightforward or right away a couple dozen times because Mark is going to proceed at a fairly fast pace. Because Mark wants to tell us what Jesus is doing and wants us to count the cost of following in his footsteps, but to at the same time realize the great joy and fulfillment in following as his disciple. On to Luke. So flip up to Luke chapter 1. We'll read that first verse there as well. If in Matthew Jesus is a rabbi, a teacher, that's what rabbi means, and if in Mark Jesus is a rebel, in Luke he is a redeemer. Now, we don't use the word redeem all that much in our culture, so let me give you a synonym. To redeem is to restore. So think of restoring an old house or an antique piece of furniture, maybe a relationship that's been broken for a number of years. Think of restoration when you think of redemption. In Luke, Jesus is the redeemer. Chapter 1, verse 1, very different than Matthew and Mark, the opening to Luke. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who were from the beginning, and they were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, verse 3, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, there's our word beginning again, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. And this is why I love Luke. For some of you, that's like, that's kind of a boring few verses. But for me, he's saying, I investigated, I put things in order, I collected them, and I'm going to lay them out before you so that you can know what truth is. Some of you know that Luke also wrote the book of Acts and that they go together. So I'm a bookworm. A good day for me is 8 hours in the library. For some of you, that'd be a hateful day. But because I'm a bookworm, I love this opening to Luke because he says, I've collected things and I'm going to lay them out. And whereas other gospel writers, maybe they were caught up a little bit in their emotions, like Mark writing about the rebel, Luke says, I'm going to sit down and take my time with us and order things so that you've got some systematic presentation of what truth is. It's found, by the way, in a person, in Jesus, his person and his words. Well, Luke's audience is Jews and Gentiles, which is one reason why it's my favorite gospel. So when Ryan said last year, I'm going to start into a series on Luke, I was like the cheerleader for that because for a couple reasons, it's my favorite gospel. And one of them is it's written for Jews and Gentiles. Written for Jews, why? Because there's a lot of Old Testament here. Not as much as Matthew, but there's a lot of Old Testament. If you read through just the first four chapters, you will have 5 or 6 quotes from Isaiah alone. In chapter 4, Jesus will quote Isaiah when he's in a synagogue, stands up, reads from a scroll, and says, what you've just heard is fulfilled in your day, meaning it's fulfilled in me, with Jesus speaking. But Luke is also written to Gentiles, to you and me. Let's look at one instance of that. Look at Luke 14. If you've got Luke open, turn up to chapter 14. Verse 21 is what I'll read from. In this verse and the verses before that, there is a rich guy that wants to throw a banquet, a feast, and he wants to invite his friends and they don't come. So he says to his servant, go out, and let's read now. Let's pick it up at verse 21, middle of that verse. So look a little bit into verse 21. The master says, go out at once into the streets and lanes of the city. Bring in here the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. This is a lot of what Luke is about, meaning what Jesus is about in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is after whom? He's after the least, not the greatest, not the first in line, the last in line. He's after the least. He's after those who are lost. He's after those who are little. I don't mean in stature. I mean people who think of themselves as insignificant, small, nobodies. If you come to Jesus and say, I am somebody. I do things that are righteous. I'm a good person. I'm more toward the front of the line. I'm more toward the head of the table. I should be at the right hand of the guy hosting the banquet, then you're not a candidate for salvation. He came for the sick to be a physician to them spiritually. So this verse in chapter 14, a great example of that. Luke tells us about lost sheep, about a lost coin, and about a lost son in Luke chapter 15. In Luke chapter 18, one of Ryan's favorite stories, which I love too, don't turn there, but you remember the story. It's the Pharisee and the tax collector, the religious guy and the irreligious guy. And which one does God favor? It's the least, the lost, and the little. It's the tax collector who says, I'm such a sinner. He even says, God be merciful to me, the sinner. T-H-E, definite article, as if there's only one big sinner in the world, and it's me. Those are the people Jesus goes after in the book of Luke because he's a redeemer. Another example of Gentile influence, not Jewish, is that we have Samaritans mentioned quite a bit in the Gospel of Luke. Now, let me review this in case you don't remember it or in case you don't know it. When the Jews were exiled to Babylon, so this is time of the book of Daniel, some Jews were left in the land. They intermarried with Canaanites, with pagans, which meant two things. One, the bloodline was diluted. They're not truly Jewish anymore. Second, they adopted much of the faith of the pagan Canaanites. And so they mixed that with the worship of Yahweh. So two bad things happen. So the Jews from Babylon come back after the exile, and they want nothing to do with Samaritans. They're scum of the earth. And in Luke, why? Because Jesus wants to redeem, and who are the candidates for redemption? The lost, the least, the little ones. Jesus goes after the Samaritans in Luke. One of the reasons why you got to love Luke, it's got this cross-cultural emphasis. So whereas other gospels don't mention the Samaritans at all, or in Matthew when they get mentioned, it's like, don't go to the Samaritans. In Luke, they get mentioned three or four times in key stories. And you may remember Acts chapter 1, when God gives the mission to the church in different wording than at the end of Matthew. God says the church should go to Jerusalem, to Judea, and what's number three? To Samaria, and then the rest of the world. So if you want to see how that looks, Acts chapter 1, verse 8, Luke is the gospel for you. Read through Luke, and you'll read about Samaritans. Luke is the gospel of response and worship and discipleship. Now, the other gospels mention that, but Luke more so. A few examples of that from Luke. These stories are unique to Luke. They're only found in Luke. The Mary and Martha story, which is all about how to respond to Jesus, is found in Luke 10. The parable of the Good Samaritan is found in Luke chapter 10. The Lord's Prayer is found in Luke 11. It's also found in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. But in Luke, when Jesus gives the Lord's Prayer, he's doing it in response to the disciples asking him, how do we pray? So it could be that if you want to learn how to pray, you look at Luke 11, not so much the beginning of Matthew. Although looking at both would be the best way to do it if you have time. Fourth and final gospel. And then we'll kind of be done with sermon one, and I'll give you a shorter sermon after that. John, if Matthew is Jesus as a rabbi, Mark is Jesus as a rebel, Luke is Jesus as our redeemer, then John is Jesus as reality, which means he's really truly God and he is really truly our Savior. And in keeping with this, Jesus is truly God, equal with the Father, John has a universal cosmic feel to it. It's not just to the Jews, it's not just to the Romans, it's not even to both, it's to everybody. Every human being living and breathing in any time period, any economic class, any ethnicity, any piece of geography on this planet. So let's look at that first verse in John. We'll see our word beginning one more time. John 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And of course, the Word being Jesus. Some key topics in John. John talks a lot about life. Well over 30 times you have the word life, usually with Jesus being life. Other gospel writers, maybe three or four times each, do they have the word life. There are seven sign acts or miracles that are meant to be signs, road signs, they point to some truth, found in the Gospel of John. Let me show you what I think is my favorite in the Gospel of John. Of the miracles, these seven key miracles that Jesus does. It's found in John chapter 2. And it's this miracle of changing water to wine. Now, I think I've said this to our church at some service before, so next few minutes might be a repeat for some of you. But this strikes me as a really odd miracle, and here's why. He's changing water to wine at a marriage feast. Now, number one, that's liquid to liquid. Number two, they're in jars, so they're hidden. Do you see why my first thought is that's not a great miracle? A great miracle would be making an elephant appear out of nothing. Or, like we saw in Mark, the guy has a withered hand, it's been deformed for years, he can't use his fingers, Jesus touches him, heals him, all of a sudden the guy has a full, complete hand, five fingers, can move them as much as we do. That's a miracle. Water to wine, while it's inside of jars, what's the deal? Well, these are sign acts. The Greek word for this miracle, semeion, means sign. Ryan's actually talked a little bit about this, that miracles are not just to make people better, although they do that. They preach a message, and often that message has to do with faith and salvation. Well, in this particular message, there's an Old Testament background. So we're just going to put this up on the screen. You don't have to turn there, but Joel chapter 3 talks about the mountains that gush with wine when Messiah comes. Many, dozens and dozens of Old Testament prophecies talk about what happens to the earth when Messiah comes. The Dead Sea area, which is just rocks right now, blossoms like the Garden of Eden. And people that grow grapes or people that have livestock, they have bumper years every year. No blight, no insects, no drought, no animals. Great abundance. Now, this will happen at Christ's second coming. Some people think it happened symbolically at his first. We don't have time for that rabbit trail. Just know that this is all future to our time right now, because we know Jesus is going to have two comings, one that's happened already, one that will happen. But here's what happened at Cana. He created an abundance of wine. This is over 150 gallons. These vats were like 3 or 4 feet tall, these jars that he created wine in. So not only is it a miracle in terms of breaking the laws of nature, but the Jews at that wedding would have thought, there's wine all over the place. That reminds me of Joel chapter 3 and a couple passages in Isaiah that talk about the Messiah. Could this guy who made the wine be the Messiah? And that's the sign of the miracle at Cana, or at least a big part of it, is that this links with the Old Testament. This is God that has come down to the earth. So that's what we read in John chapter 2, verse 11. This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory. John has 7 I am statements. And in John, we read about the Father and his relationship with the Son much more than the other three Gospels. I think over 100 times we read the word Father, and it's Christ talking about God the Father. And our conclusion can be no other after reading John, but that the two are one and the same. Different in person, but equally God. What the Father does, the Son does. Who the Father is, the Son is. So our conclusion, end of sermon 1, 4 Gospels, 1 Jesus. Like 4 eyewitnesses who are all completely accurate and who provide information that helps when you're looking at this automobile accident. Sermon number 2, which will be a lot shorter. My favorite thing about Luke. So turn back to Luke. We're going to start with Luke chapter 11. Here's how I'm going to summarize the last half of the book of Luke. In the last half of the book of Luke, it's not the only thing Jesus does, but among other things, Jesus discerns, meaning he makes an observation and then he draws conclusions from that observation. Jesus discerns the comfort zones of individuals or groups of people. And after he discerns that, he comes against that comfort zone or that area of idolatry. And he will challenge that comfort zone. So bear with me. We'll look at 7 or 8 verses in which I hope to prove this to you. Luke chapter 11, verses 37-38. Now, when he had spoken, this is Jesus, a Pharisee asked him to have lunch with him. And he, Jesus, went in and reclined at the table. When the Pharisee saw it, what is he seeing? Jesus just comes right in and sits down. He was surprised that he, Jesus, had not first ceremonially washed before the meal. So what is Jesus discerning here? That here's a Pharisee. He's all about cleanliness, which in this case is not from Old Testament commandments, but the traditions of men built up around Old Testament commandments. And Jesus will come against that because that's what the Pharisee is trusting in. So we won't read it, but Jesus responds with some words against that practice. Next verse, chapter 14, flip forward a few pages to verse 7 of chapter 14. And he, this is Jesus, began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, verse 8 starts his parable. Again, read it on your own. What's happening? He's at a banquet. As people come in, they want to get to the head of the table. They want to sit at the right hand of the guy at the very head of the table because that's the position of honor. And if that's filled, maybe next one down, because the closer they are to the top, the better they look. Jesus sees that they're trusting in that kind of social status, and what will he do? Come against it, challenge it, speak against idolatry. Next verse, chapter 15. It might be on the same page for you or one page over. Chapter 15, verse 2. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Now again, that's a big part of Luke, if you remember, that Jesus hangs out with sinners, with Samaritans. I think the word sinners occurs more in Luke than any other gospel. But here, the religious people are grumbling and complaining against that. So guess what Jesus will do? Give a parable, in this case actually three parables, against that kind of attitude, that kind of grumbling. Next verse, chapter 16, next chapter, verse 14. We're going to see the same thing, the same kind of thing. Verse 14, now the Pharisees who were lovers of money were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. What do you think Jesus will do? Since he notices that they're putting their trust in money, he'll speak against it. Next chapter, chapter 18, verse 9. And he, Jesus, also told this parable to some people who, Luke's doing the same thing, trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Jesus discerns something. What are they trusting in? Themselves, that they're righteous. And what will he do? Speak against that. He won't go home and study it and think about it for a couple weeks and then try to hunt up those people again. At that moment, he'll speak to it. Chapter 19, verse 11. While they were listening to these things, Jesus went on to tell a parable because he was near Jerusalem and they supposed that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately. What are these people trusting in? Jesus is going to come in that sense of the Old Testament prophecies of setting everything right. The desert blossoms, the mountains drip, just gush with sweet wine. Human governments are toppled, and Jesus himself is literally physically king over the earth. They're trusting in that, and Jesus will speak against it because it's not time for that yet. Chapter 21, two more verses. Very beginning of chapter 21, first verse. He, Jesus, looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And so some of you know the story in verse 2. He looks at a poor widow who puts in a penny or two and contrasts the two because he's going to speak against putting your trust in money. And one more verse, a few verses down, chapter 21, verse 5. While some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he, Jesus, said, he's going to speak against people that trust in buildings, in religious tradition and artifice. and not him. So one of the big things Jesus is doing, second half of the book of Luke, is this. One more time. He's discerning comfort zones and challenging them, coming against them. What does that mean for you and me? I don't think it so much means that we go around and try to do the same thing Jesus did. Let's say that I see David here doing something, and for a few seconds, a little slice of his life, I think that he's trusting in money. Does that mean I come up to him and challenge him, come against him, and speak some parables against him? Probably not. Now, for close friends, I think that probably is an appropriate thing to do, at least to question things. So hopefully you have some people in your life that do that to you and in turn want you to speak that into their lives. That is truth, which sometimes is confrontational. But I'm not saying you observe something and then you do exactly what Jesus did. I think Luke's goal in this is more for us to be introspective, for us to examine ourselves, to say, what are our idols? As we read through the second half of Luke, which one of these is me? Is it trusting in money? Is it trusting in religious activities? Is it trusting in being clean and orderly and organized? Is it trusting in some quick delivery to what I see as a problem and a crisis that somehow caught God by surprise that I'm in the middle of? Which one of these people is me? And hopefully I don't read through and say, you know what, it's none of them. I'm so thankful that I don't trust in money. I don't trust in religion. I don't trust in things. I don't trust in social status, the guy at the head of the table. Wow, how great that none of these fit me. But wow, it kind of is bad that some of them fit my wife Carla and my friend David and my fellow staff member Clint and a bunch of other people in my life. Man, avoid that at all costs. If anything, try to see yourself in every one of these people groups and let God tell you, no, it's really more the one that's coming up in the next chapter that you need to be worried about.